This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Standard Issue for all women.
Hello and welcome to episode 300 of the Standard Issue Podzy. I'm Mickey Noonan. Hero status unlocked. I successfully gave blood. Okay.
Oh, right. Well,
I know,
done.
I know.
That's good to hear.
It's good. No vein collapse. All went swimmingly. It was a bit slow. They made me do all of the squeezing. But apart from that, all good.
How do people find out about giving blood, Mickey?
I think if you just Google giving blood or blood donating
right.
and NHS, then it will come up and you should absolutely do that because it makes you feel amazing.
And how do you to pronounce YouTube?
It's Yaotube. You can probably find some videos on there. I was just saying to Hannah, there's been a kind of poll done on the hardest to pronounce brand names, and they've done this by working out how many thousands of people and months look up how to pronounce a certain brand name. Top of the list, Nike, which is Nike, not Nike. At number six, Jen, could you maybe guess what might be at number six on the list of hardest to pronounce brand names?
Is it on the basis of what you've just said, YouTube?
It's actually Apple is number six. Sorry, Apple, I play, which has more than 6,000 people each month looking up how to pronounce Apple.
Is this like a global thing?
No, I think it was within the UK.
I mean, I can't. People voted Noel Edmonds out first on I'm a Celebrity. I'll say it again. There's no accounting for, like, well, anything. Can't trust the British public.
Given you're in charge of the country, it's interesting that you do still keep going back to the Noel Edmonds thing, Jen, which says more about you than about anyone else. But yeah, YouTube was number seven.
Wow. Like, I just... Oh, people.
Anyway, I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and I've been enjoying some wet panic.
Sympathies, mate, sympathies. It's the worst panic.
Got a message off my neighbour to say that rather than emptying through the traditional route, my shower had emptied through his lounge ceiling.
It's not a good thing. No.
It's not.
No.
It's not. I found a plumber. He was very nice. Two brothers, they're from Kurdistan, and they came around and fixed it incredibly quickly. I only mentioned they're from Kurdistan because they chatted away to my cats in a language that I said, yeah, they're not going to understand that. And he looks at me like, do you think they understand the language you speak?
God, that is so like when I look after our friend Liz's cat and I meowed at him. And he looked at me as if to say, what the fuck is happening? So I meowed again and he was like, his head was just tilted. So when Liz got back, I was like, do you not meow at mate? And she said, no, he speaks English.
My brother once started a war between our cats that lasted days by meowing at one of them. He obviously said something very rude in cat because the other one like looks at the cat like that, like turned her head like, what did you just say to me? And they had a scrap and they didn't speak to each other for days.
What have your plumbers started, Hannah? Ooh, watch this space.
I'm Jen Offord and my daughter cracks me up.
Well,
like,
that's
for lots
good.
Of reasons.
It's good, right? Because I'm sure there's other things that tear your hair out.
So on Sunday, we went for a little walk, give our leg a little stretch, and we went past the church and the bells were ringing and she wanted to go in and have a look. She'd been in the church before, I don't know why, but she wanted to go in. So we went in and she immediately starts running around and there's like three quite elderly ladies in there who like know my mum a bit, and it's a big church and it's very quiet. So she runs straight over to where the toys are, and I'm just sort of going, oh, she just wanted to come in and have a look. And they're like, oh, lovely, lovely. Yeah, absolutely lovely. She runs straight over to the toys, and she's got this toy at home. It's like a checkout at a supermarket, and it's got like a little microphone on it, so you can like obviously...
like a tannoy system.
Basically.
Spillage on aisle four.
Yeah, so she goes straight over
to that. It's just the one aisle, to be honest, in the church.
Presses the button, leans in and goes, can someone bring some pasta, please?
I suppose it's like praying, right? Like people are just praying for pasta.
In a way.
Yeah.
In a way.
Two questions.
Yeah.
Number one, what sort of church has fucking toys in it?
Oh, loads of churches have toys
in. Yeah, they want the kids to come in. They want to indoctrinate them young. So they like lure them in with a Peppa Pig house with a real flushing toilet noise. So,
Second thing is, a friend of mine who is a comedian, when she had her little boy, he had one of those sort of carry around with a microphone attached thing. And
like a karaoke system.
Yeah, well, it was like that, but it was for kids' things. So you could carry it.
And, then,
and he just used to walk around and go, joke, joke, joke.
I feel like we could all do with one of those these days, just to make sure people understand that we are, you know, joking. Just, it's just all lols, guys.
On the subject of lols, sort of. Coming up, I chat to theatre company Dirty Hair about witches, history and their play, Gunter, not Gunter.
Good pronunciation there. I play Yao Tu Bie. It's good to check. It's good to check. And we're all aware of the glass ceiling, right?
Yes.
Well, once a woman smashed through that, she's the glass cliff to contend with. Sophie Williams tells me more about the phenomenon befalling high-flying women and why it matters to all of us.
In Journey Off the Blocks, I'm talking rugby, cricket and more, and in Rated or Dated, top that.
Easy. So easy to top that.
It really is. I'm so sorry. But we watch / cringe along to 1989's Teen Witch.
But first... abortion laws, Ukrainian opera, and literal rivers of shite. It's time for the Bush Telegraph. Get your wellies on.
Bush Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph, where we are shook, shook, I tell you, to discover that something David Cameron is in charge of has been deemed, quote, somewhat elite.
Oh, what bastard said that?
I know, they clearly don't understand that he is the man of the people and everyone in the Foreign Office sail along in that ship.
Do they not remember Hugger Hoodie?
Man of all people, that's what he is, and indeed, Piggly Wigglies.
Apologies, Joan is joining in, but fair enough, because she knows quite a lot about Eaton, don't you?
Is that eating or Eaton?
Eaton, well, yeah, bit about Eaton, and by Eaton I mean Peggy's dinner. Now, we quite often talk about shit shows in the Bush Telegraph, and it's largely a metaphor, but I want to talk about a literal shit show that's happening across the UK, including in Scotland.
Scotland? Oh, interesting.
Because, and you might have missed this given the amount of metaphorical crap in the news in the last few weeks, last month it was recorded that water companies released record spills of raw sewage into the sea and rivers in England in 2023.
I mean, usually when people are breaking records, we're like, woo, where's Norris McWhirter? This is exciting, but I'm not as excited for this one, Hannah.
Yeah, I mean, you get thrown out of a swimming pool for having a quick way, but you're allowed to put 4 tonnes of poo in the river.
Are they still not letting you back in?
According to the Environment Agency, there were 3.6 million hours of spills compared to 1.75 million hours in 2022. Now, if you're thinking, what volume exactly is discharged in an hour, join the club.
Yep.
The number of hours has more than doubled. So what I can say for certain is, that ain't great.
Not good.
There are, of course, rules on what you can discharge and when, and a limited discharge of excess sewage during periods of rain is within those rules. But last year, a BBC investigation found evidence of dry spills, with Thames, Wessex and Southern Water illegally discharging sewage hundreds of times on days when it was not raining. Dry spilling is banned because it can lead to higher concentrations of sewage in waterways, which damage a river's ecosystem and pose a health risk to swimmers. Too much shit, Sherlock.
Absolutely. Can I just say, Hannah, I'm really proud of how many times you've managed to say discharge and spills and managed not to vomit.
I'm doing quite well.
Campaign group top of the Popes.
Wait, sorry, I'm sorry, but come on now. Come on now. Credit where it's due.
It says new figures are likely to be an underestimate because companies don't monitor sites reliably or consistently. In February, Rishi Sunak, remember him?
Still in.
Said he would welcome tougher fines for water companies and denied reports that the government is backing away from plans to hit water companies with fines of up to £250 million for dumping sewage into rivers and seas. Now, I've only mentioned England so far, but here we are. According to Top of the Popes, the most polluted rivers in the UK.
I kind of want to do the theme tune from Top of the Pops.
Brace yourself, Wales. The Severn, the Calder, the Aire, the Derwent, the Ouse, the Tamar, the Trent, the Tyvee, the Erewash and the Usk. Other turd-filled rivers are also available. But what about Scotland? I hear you and Apple Podcast reviewers ask, how many jobbies end up in their water? Well, sewage is being dumped into Scotland's rivers and waterways more than 50 times a day. That's according to an investigation published last month in The Eye. That's 40% higher than previously thought. However, this is likely only a fraction of the total, as just 4% of overflows are monitored by Scottish Water, which is publicly owned. In England, 89% of overflows are monitored. And that's not because we're better human beings, just to be clear. Former Undertones frontman and now water company botherer Fergal Sharkey told the Daily Record, quote, Scotland's first problem is simply the sheer lack of monitoring. But from the few bits of data available, there is just as big a scale of sewage dumping going on in Scotland as there is in England and Wales. And what about Northern Ireland? Well, in March, it was reported that 1 in 8 water pollution incidents were linked to the operations of Northern Ireland Water, with another quarter being linked to agriculture. An NI Audit Office report found that water quality in rivers and lakes has not improved since 2015 and that a 2027 EU target for standards will be missed. But NI Water was fined just £170,000 after releasing an average of 70 million tonnes of sewage into local rivers and lakes in the past 10 years. Why is that? Well, NI Water is a public utility and it is deemed counterproductive for fines to be imposed. So, what's the damage caused by all these leaks other than literal rivers of shit? According to experts, ecosystems are out of balance. Microscopic bacteria are being spread and can rapidly multiply into algal blooms, causing extensive dead zones once oxygen in the water has been used up. Dangerous outbreaks of sewage fungus. I mean, could fungus sound even worse before you put the word sewage in front of it? Dangerous outbreaks of sewage fungus are becoming a big problem for the UK's rivers, ponds and lakes too. Where is the hope? Well, I suppose there is some. 27 new bathing sites are being considered for England. If all these sites are granted, it will be the largest ever number of bathing sites in rivers, lakes and coastal areas approved in a single year. Bathing water status means the government is obliged to test the quality of the water throughout the summer months. A government consultation on these sites ended on the 10th of March. Don't know when it's going to report. But if you're thinking that they won't do anything about the literal cack because the government is metaphorical cack, it is worth pointing out that almost all these new bathing sites are in Tory constituencies.
Still don't vote for them, though. That's what I'm saying. Still don't vote for them. No.
If they're going to do this in an attempt to win the next election, just let them do it. Just let them do that. And then at least some people might not be swimming in literal shit.
Yeah, big fan of that, totally. And they're making all sorts of promises as if they haven't had 14 years to enact it.
Yeah.
Did you have quite a nice time with all of the wordplay there, though, Hannah?
Did enjoy using the word jobbies. I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's another great reason to be Scottish, isn't it? And we just don't have time to go through all of them.
Talking about Scotland, you and I went to see Kieran Hodgson's Made in Scotland. Big in Scotland on Friday night. And it was really, really, really great, I thought.
It was really great. So great that Hannah forgot it was Saturday night. She was just like, oh, this must be Friday night. It's amazing. That's how good it was. I have no segue because let's talk abortion. I know, again. I'm going to be honest with you. We'll be harping on about abortion for as long as it's not a contested right for women to have autonomy over their own body and choices on this matter. Another woman who's long been talking abortion rights, despite the heinous amount of shit she gets for it. Basically, she is the C and they are like chucking it into Stella Creasy, who is my MP. So it's no surprise. Did you want to say something else?
No, I just wanted to say jobbies, Mickey.
Oh, Hannah, trying to be serious about abortion. Anyway, it is no surprise to find Creasy heading up fresh proposals to modernise abortion law in England and Wales. A cross-party group of MPs is putting forward legislation that would decriminalise abortion up to 24 weeks and introduce protections against access being stripped back. And these come in the form of amendments to the government's Criminal Justice Bill. Because yes, to answer someone clearly shocked in the comments under Creasy's Instagram post about this, abortion is still technically illegal in England and Wales under the 1861 Offences Against the Persons Act. The 1967 Abortion Act exempted women and those who assist them from prosecution under stringent conditions. But in the past 10 years, there have been 67 prosecutions with many more women investigated, including recently a 15-year-old girl who suffered a stillbirth at 28 weeks and faced a year-long police investigation, only dropped after a post-mortem found that her pregnancy loss was indeed the result of natural causes. Yeah, the 15-year-old girl that was pregnant is definitely where police attention should have been focused in this case. Creasy said, enshrining abortion as a human right will prevent further attacks on access as well as those who assist women to ensure abortion can be safe, legal and local. The public is very clear. The 95% of women who have early abortion should not have to justify their choice. And the small number of women who tragically have abortions towards the end of pregnancy need our support not to be sent to prison. It's time that our law reflected this and came into line with the rest of Western Europe. The amendments are due to be debated after Parliament returns from its Easter recess later this month. Speaker Sir Lindsay Hoyle will choose which ones are voted on, with MPs expected to be given a free vote.
Yeah, I saw a couple of Tory MPs this morning on Twitter saying, Stella Creasy won't stop till you can murder a full-term baby. Or words along those lines. I mean, that's not much of an exaggeration on what they said.
No, I also saw that. Stella Creasy has written a piece for The Guardian and she says halfway down that this is what's going to happen. These are the tactics used by extremists in America, the anti-choice extremists in America. And that isn't what this is for. Women are going to be queuing up to carry a pregnancy almost to term and then have an abortion. Like, pregnancy is just a fun thing you do for 9 months, right?
Exactly. As if it's not having any impact on your life. If you don't want to be pregnant, you don't want to be pregnant as soon as you possibly can.
And the fact of the matter is that most of the late-term abortions are much, much wanted pregnancies where something has gone tragically wrong.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a whole other level of emotional turmoil going on there.
And if you're going to have, if you're that desperate that you're going to have a late-stage abortion, is the threat of going to prison going to stop you?
I also think if you are at that stage, I mean, this is so,
you're not even thinking clearly,
so
rare,
are you? Then it isn't the police that you need, it's mental health.
It's mental health, exactly that. Mickey, I've got a good news story from Ukraine. Do you want to hear it?
I absolutely do.
Because that, I mean, that's a place in desperate need of good news. We're going to Kharkiv, Ukraine's second city, which is just 25 miles from the Russian border. Which goes some way to explaining why mass gatherings have been banned since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion. This means that cultural life has mostly ground to a halt, and the events that do take place are largely spread by word of mouth to make sure they aren't targeted by Russian shelling. Exacerbating the problem is the fact that many Ukrainian artists are either living overseas, on the front line, or have, sadly, died in the fighting. But after 2 years, the Kharkiv National Opera and Ballet is about to return in a bunker underneath the main auditorium of their home. We want to bring life back to Kharkiv, including cultural life, the theatre's general director, Ihor Tulazov, told the BBC. Vladimir Kozlov, a baritone who performed with fellow artists for people sheltering in metro stations during the early stage of the war, will be performing in the bunker alongside his wife, Yulia Forsuk, who is a soprano. Everything was grey before and there was no future, he said. Now a rainbow has appeared on the horizon.
That is really lovely, good news. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. And, you know, break a leg, guys. That sounds like an amazing thing to do.
Absolutely.
More news next week.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week.
It's that time of the week where... Actually, do you know what? I'm going to scrap my usual opener because I have decided we should have a bonus good news story.
Specifically, look at you!
I know! Specifically for women, Hannah.
Oh, Mickey, with these good news stories.
I mean, it is. Oh, sorry, carry on.
I was going to say, you're really spoiling us, but yeah, I mean, as if that hasn't been used a thousand times. Crack on, Mickey, crack on.
It is, but of course, tentative. And yet... hopeful stuff happened in Turkey's local elections last week when, for the first time in more than two decades, the Republican People's Party, or CHP, they are the main opposition party, was victorious at a national level, meaning President Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, the AKP, who are currently in government, lost the popular vote, including in Istanbul, which is pretty much seen as the place that decides what's going to happen. So there's no doubt the results of these local elections were a national shot in the arm for a secular, liberal and modern Turkey. Why is this in sexism of the week, though, Mick? Well, under the AKP and mainly over the last 10 years, Turkey has witnessed a regression in women's rights and gender equality goals. The AKP government has unilaterally withdrawn from the Istanbul Convention aimed at protecting the victims of gender violence.
The irony.
I know. Like, come on. It's literally your convention. In 2023 alone, at least 563 women were killed or lost their lives in suspicious circumstances. A third of all marriages in the country involved child brides. And so this shift in itself is heartening. But adding to the country's changing political landscape is an increase in the number of female representatives. Female mayors now rule 11 out of 81 cities, including in Batman.
What?
I know, I can't tell you how happy I am to discover there's a place called Batman. I wish I'd known about this sooner. But I mean, it didn't sound like it was a very fun place to live until, you know, these changes. So in Batman, Gulistan Sonuk of the pro-Kurdish People's Equality and Democracy Party took 65% of the vote, and she was applauded enthusiastically by crowds chanting, "Women, life, freedom," in an emotional reference to the plight of women in Iran. Hope, hey? Oh, it gets you in the heart and the throat every time, innit?
Yeah. As you know, I was in Istanbul last year, and in almost every public space, there were these huge groups of men, mostly, I would say, 40 up, most of them, I would say, some of them quite elderly, standing around in what my nephew and I immediately thought looked like rap battles. Except they weren't rapping, but they were all grabbing the mic off each other and shouting. And when we went on a tour, we asked our tour guide what it was. And she said, oh, there's an election. Old men like to talk bullshit.
Well, the people who Gulistan Sonuk was up against, the party whose name I haven't written down, apologies, but was very male dominated, had promised women that when they were elected, they would allow women to choose what colour veil they wanted to wear. So it's a real fuck you to them as well, which obviously is great. All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression, and while over time and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much. That does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution. in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard. Hello, I'm joined on the Zoom by Sophie Williams, ex-global leader at Netflix, former very bigwig at various advertising agencies, and author of new book, The Glass Cliff, Why Women in Power Are Undermined and How to Fight Back. Sophie, hello.
Howdy, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Why do we have to fight so hard all the time?
Yeah, it's bullshit, isn't it? It'd be so much better if we didn't. And I don't know if you've ever written a book or how many of your guests are authors, but generally speaking, we don't write our own subtitles. So I didn't actually even write that bit. So yeah, the whole fighting back, I am all about a life of softness. I'm all about a life of ease. I really love to not be like, here's how we're going to fight the power. But I think until the power has been sort of firmly and equally distributed, we might need to do a little bit of it.
Totally. I totally agree. Okay, let's start with the basics. I think most of us know what the glass ceiling is. I'm sure some of our listeners have bumped their heads against it. But what exactly is the glass cliff and why was it first labelled as such?
So the glass cliff is really what happens after the glass ceiling. I'm sure that you and your listeners are really familiar, as you say, with the conversations about that glass ceiling and what it's like to live underneath it, what it's like to work underneath it, what it's like to have your potential limited and, you know, never be able to reach those top spots. But in reality, we know that women do break through that glass ceiling. It's not sort of this fait accompli that we were sort of led to believe it might be when we were young people. We do see women rising to leadership positions. And so the glass cliff really looks at what that is like. I was really, when I first started investigating this, looking for stories of success. I was looking for stories of women taking on leadership positions and absolutely thriving, having the time of their lives, you know, bossing it and turning fortunes around and doing all of this great stuff. But in reality, I kept coming across stories that were labeling women in leadership as failures and talking about why they couldn't do these things. And so I started looking at, you know, why is this narrative? Why is this happening? Are women worse leaders? And what we found, instead of this narrative of women not actually being set up to lead, was a story of context and a story of unfair beginnings. So what the glass cliff essentially is it sees that women are disproportionately given the opportunity to step into leadership positions when a business is in crisis or some kind of moment of huge upheaval. And that means that women are inheriting much more difficult leadership positions from the very start, which means that their chances of actually being successful in those roles are limited before they've even begun, through no fault of their own and not through their lack of ability.
We see a lot of women being brought in to clean up a mess or take care of a company in trouble, right?
Absolutely. We see it all the time and we're all familiar with it with so many areas of our lives. If we think about the context that led to Theresa May becoming the second female prime minister of the UK, if you look at Boeing, who are in, I mean, I made a joke the other day that their business and their planes are equally and literally falling apart, and they have just now turned to a female CEO. We see all of these businesses, organizations, institutions, you know, political parties are so comfortable being led and headed up by the traditional white male image of leadership. And they only seem to take a break from that double demographic when there's a problem to solve or a mess to clean up. in the book, I talk about this idea of this sociological phenomenon, which is called think leader, think male, think manager, think male. And we have all been so socialized in this idea of male leadership, and not only male leadership, but if we're being honest, if we're talking intersectionally, white male leadership, that we only really see businesses taking a chance on deviating from that when we see the second phenomenon come into play, which is known as think crisis, think female.
Yeah. Now, your book, which I have to say, takes some pretty heavy evidence and stats and makes them into a really engaging read. I was excited to read it, but I was a bit like, oh, this is probably going to be a bit chewy, and was delighted that your writing style is so easy. It's a really lovely read. It has a case study of a real life woman stood on a glass cliff at the start of each chapter. As soon as I heard the title of your book, you'd already mentioned her. I was waiting for her. There she was, chapter 3, Theresa May, she who gulped from the poison chalice that was being prime minister straight after the Brexit vote. Can you explain a little how she so beautifully epitomises the glass cliff phenomenon?
Yeah, absolutely. And she's a really good example of it, which is really annoying because I'm not a Tory. And now I have to be like, oh, the poor Tory prime minister, didn't she have a hard time? And like, she did, but also, come on.
I mean, yeah, it's harder to feel sympathy when you're talking about the shower of cunts in charge, but she does really perfectly epitomise this.
And we'll come to it in a minute, but I think we're going to see the glass cliff playing out really clearly in the next election as well. But talking about the Theresa May prime ministership, what we saw was we saw a group of men lead the UK to a referendum around Britain's continued inclusion within the European Union. And not only did Theresa May not lead us to that point, she was not for that referendum. Yeah. She was a Remain. She wanted the UK to remain as part of the European Union. However, when the UK, when the public did vote to Brexit, did vote to leave the European Union, all of the men who had led us to that point, whether that's David Cameron, who actually led the referendum, whether that's Nigel Farage, who was, you know, this was his whole thing, right? This was the only thing he wanted. Suddenly, they were nowhere to be seen. They disappeared. What that led to, what that left, was essentially a bit of a power vacuum at the top. And what we'd expected in the lead up to that was to see people like Boris Johnson coming in and claiming that prime ministership, something that they'd always very clearly, very openly, very ambitiously wanted. But instead, what we saw was this vacuum and left space for Theresa May, who was someone who hadn't really historically publicly stated these sort of leadership ambitions. And so what we see is when there's a big problem, when there's a big crisis, when there's a big thing to solve, and, you know, Brexit is a pretty big thing to solve.
It's not been solved yet. They have not got it done.
That's true, actually. But when we see this, we see that men who are so used to having more opportunities to advance to leadership positions step back from that position. They step back and they say, actually, this is a really hard thing to be successful in. And I'm really confident that whether it's in a year, in 5 years, in 10 years, I will have an opportunity that is better for me. I have an opportunity that will set me up better for success. Whereas women and racially marginalised men, and let's not forget, after Trust, not after Trust, we don't talk about Trust, after they, we got Sunak, and we see the glass cliff in both women and racially marginalised men. So when we have these big issues, when we have these big moments of really high likelihood of not being seen to be a public success, we see these people who are so not used to being offered leadership positions suddenly getting that opportunity and not having that mindset of their white male counterparts of, I'll wait for something better to come around, and instead thinking, well, this is my chance. This is the only chance I've got. I've never been given an opportunity like this before. And so I'm going to have to shoot that shot, even if it's a long shot. And so we see Theresa May coming in and doing a really hard Brexit. You see her coming in and embracing Brexit means Brexit and getting the job done and really not being able to rely on the support of her team. So in short, we see Theresa May coming into a Brexit referendum that she didn't call in, that she wasn't in favour for, fighting against her team to try and get this deal, not having their support, essentially being pushed out and then being replaced by Boris Johnson, who was able to wait in the background for a moment that was safer, that he knew would come, that he'd have a better opportunity to lead. Whereas women who don't get given these opportunities have to grab and take and embrace and try and run with whatever it is that they can sort of get their hands on in that moment.
Well, Sophie, you've touched on several fascinating things that I really wanted to talk to you about there. That chapter is called Worth the Risk? Question mark. And she knew, right? We've got to think that Theresa May, she might not be our cup of tea, but she's a smart woman. She knew what she was getting herself into.
I hope so. I really, really hope so.
Yeah.
And same can be said. So for your listeners, Linda Yaccarino, who's taken over as the CEO of Twitter or X after Elon Musk tweeted that he would step down when he found someone stupid enough to take on the role.
Saying the quiet bit out loud, that's Elon's thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there is no quiet bit for him, I don't think. He's a
very loud man.
And Stephanie Pope has just taken over as the CEO of Boeing. We see it there as well. And these are, in a lot of ways, interesting examples of the glass cliff because they are so out there, because they are so publicly front and center, a big problem that needs solving. So often what we see is women taking on these leadership roles in businesses that are having quiet problems, problems that haven't quite hit the PR cycle yet, problems that are linked to stock price or revenue or, you know, that market positioning. And so the examples of Theresa May or Linda Yaccarino or Stephanie Pope, I really hope are examples of people who have not been blindsided by the glass cliff in the way that so many women are. I really hope that they've gone in with a plan and a strategy and at least the knowledge that success will be harder to come by. But again, it might be that that's not the case. It might be that they see the opportunities, they see their careers, they know how and how often things come their way, and they think this is not likely to be a great success story, but it is likely to be my best or my only chance at a success story. So I hope.
The other thing you mentioned when we were chatting about Theresa May there is that she did not have the support of her team, and that is something that goes hand in hand with the glass cliff phenomenon.
Absolutely. And so what we often see is these women are brought into these positions when there's a big problem like we've been speaking about, and they're brought in with the expectation that they're going to either play mother and make everyone feel better, or they're going to be a visible scapegoat. They're going to become the face of the problem, they're going to become the face of the issue. And what do we do when we solve the issue? We get rid of those people. And so we see them being exited. So we see these women coming into these really, really difficult to win scenarios. And even the best leader in the world, regardless of their gender, they're not going to completely turn around a failing, struggling team in crisis on their own. That's not how leadership works. We all work together. We all work as part of a team. And so if someone who's been brought in can't get the support of that team, then their chances of being successful are again reduced because they need that cohort, they need that support, they need that work to make their plans come to life, to bring them to fruition and to do all of that work. One of the difficulties of bringing women or racially marginalized men into positions where the chances of success are already so limited is part of the reason that people do that is this idea of novelty. It's this idea of, we've tried everyone who is this traditional think manager, think male leader. We're trying something different. You know, we're doing a silly one. We're going kooky. Oh, and so they bring in these people who at least externally don't look like the people who've got us to this point of crisis. But because women are so often seen as being unsuccessful leaders because of these circumstances that they inherit, that means that when we bring a woman or a black or grey majority man into these leadership positions, it's really hard to convince the teams that that's the right thing to do, that that's a safe thing to do. Because as much as anyone else, they read the think pieces about why women aren't good leaders. They see all these, you know, stories that come out that ignore the context that women are hired into. And so instead of being this reassuring moment or factor for the teams themselves, they make them worried. They make them feel, even if they're in the best pair of hands, they make them feel like they might not be. And so instead of wanting to attach their careers and pin their colours to this, what is in their mind, risky leader, they disinvest, they pull back, they don't support, they don't get involved in making those plans a success, they don't buy in. And so we already have someone inheriting a crisis, and then just by nature of who they are, what they look like, or what they are seen to represent, the very people who are essential for being part of turning that crisis into a success pull back don't support, and so we only continue to push those leaders further and further to the edge of that cliff.
It's very individualistic, isn't it? This was something that sort of surprised me when I was reading your book, because I knew about the glass cliff. I was already interested in it as a phenomenon, but it's not a global phenomenon.
No, you're right. I was actually also really, really surprised by this. One of the early things that came up while I was writing is I was having a conversation with my editor, and he was saying, oh, I'd looked at some bits around the glass cliff. Have you seen this research paper that shows that it doesn't really exist in Turkey? And I was like, I have. I think that's really interesting. And he was like, I think this is a problem, actually, with this book we're writing about the glass cliff. And I was like, I think this is actually a huge opportunity, because that means it's not a fact of nature. If women all over the world, in every circumstance, in every country, in every context, were only being given these opportunities in these moments of crisis, and that meant that we kept seeing women not being as successful as they otherwise would be, that would be a self-fulfilling prophecy. That would be something that we couldn't do anything about. We could learn about it and we could accept it and we could sort of, you know, figure it out from there. But it doesn't exist everywhere in the world. The glass cliff only really exists in Western society. And the researchers think that that is because we are much more individualistic, as you say. And so all of your successes, all of my successes, all of your failures, all of my failures, we view them as being due to us, due to me, due to you, due to our skills, due to our aptitude, due to our ability, due to how hard we work or don't. And that means that we don't often do what we need to do to see the systemic or the structural issues that impact us. And we saw this when we had those public conversations about race that people hadn't had for so long when 2020 came around. We saw people suddenly being like, what is systemic? What is structural? What does all of this mean? And we can do exactly the same, and we have to do exactly the same to the glass cliff. Because if I lose my job because it was said that I wasn't a good enough leader, that's me. If Theresa May loses her job because she said that she wasn't a good enough leader, that's just her. If you lose your job, listener, because it's been said that you're not a good enough leader, that's just you. But if we can zoom out on all of them, and if we can see, actually, we all inherited really hard-to-win situations. We all were brought in these contexts. We can start to take it away from the individual and see those sort of strands and through lines that impact all of our experiences. But because we don't, because we think of ourselves as individuals, because we think of ourselves as only being impacted or only having the possibility of being impacted by the very deliberate and personality-driven things that you or I do, we then don't have the opportunity to see, oh, this wasn't about me. This was about us. This wasn't about my aptitude for leadership. This was about the context and the situations that we all get the opportunity to lead in. So yeah, the glass cliff doesn't exist in places like Turkey, which are seen as being much more, one, matrilineal, and two, much less individualistic, because they're better able to, one, expect women in these positions of leadership, and two, see the through lines when a group of people keep having the same experience, instead of really zooming in and saying it's an individual thing.
Totally. And that, you know, it explains why, look, I'm just going to use the Tories as a scapegoat, don't care. But like the Tories cling on to this idea of meritocracy, and it's because it keeps people that look like them in power. But, and it's something that I've said before, it's like, well, we haven't seen a female leader of the Labour Party. You know, it feels like the Conservatives have been ahead of the game here. But at the same time, the flip side of that is, Margaret Thatcher notwithstanding, it has been this kind of, well, we've tried it. We've tried a woman. They don't work. Whereas the failure of so many men is just seen as that individual's failure, as opposed to standing for all womankind.
Absolutely. And it's going to be really interesting after Rishi stops being prime minister, how we then pass his race and his gender. Are we going to say, actually, we've tried a non-white man and we've had enough of that, actually, look, we got a recession, we got all of this, we didn't like it. Is his maleness or is his Asianness going to be the thing that comes to define his leadership? Or will we see different things retrospectively defining his leadership, depending on whether we want to make a point about him being good or bad? We don't know yet. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
It really is, isn't it?
none of us probably are going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party. I truly hope not.
No one in this conversation is going to be the next leader of the Conservative Party.
Just wouldn't suit us.
No, I don't think we'd get on.
However, if the next leader of the Conservative Party is a woman, the stories that we tell about her are going to matter to the next generation of women who are imagining their futures. And if the story that we tell is set up to be a story of failure, no matter what she does, from the minute that she takes on that role, that's a worse story than the story I would like to be able to tell about women going forwards.
I think the other thing that was really interesting reading your book, because there is an aspect of like you know, if you're teetering on that glass cliff, you're already doing pretty well. Like, why should I care? Because I am not earning millions or the CEO of Netflix or any of that. And the reason's really clear, because everything underneath it needs to change too, so that women will then have the support of the team. And then this glass cliff gets rarer and rarer because the people in the team can see themselves in the same way that the white men who are massively overrepresented through middle management and above just want to see themselves. That's what we need to change. And that's why this is an important conversation. The Glass Cliff is published by Macmillan Business and out now. Where can people follow you on the socials to find out what else you're up to, please?
I only use Instagram, so you can find me on my personal account, which is at Sophie Williams Official, or you can find me on what I call my big account, which is at Official Millennial Black, which is the title of my second book. And I didn't really have sort of legacy planning when I was thinking about setting up my social account. Yeah, at Sophie Williams Official, if you want to see some nonsense on a Saturday and whatever I got from the charity shop this week.
Yes.
Or at Official Millennial Black, if you want to talk to a serious businesswoman who occasionally will still show you what she got from the charity shop.
I'm in. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
I am joined by Rachel Lemon.
Hello.
Lydia Higman.
Hey, everyone.
And Julia Grogan.
Hello.
You did that beautifully, guys. who make up the theatre company, Dirty Hair. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
First of all, I would like to ask you, because you guys are co-creators of the play that we're going to talk about in a minute, Gunter. Where does Dirty Hair come from? What's the name all about?
My mum actually has this kind of affinity with hairs. She's like, she absolutely loves them. So I actually have a tattoo of a hair. So does my mum and sister. So does Julia as well. That was the hair thing. So Julia and I sort of formed a company when we were about 21 or something.
Yeah,
we were putting on our first show and we called it Daring Hair. Now, when Rachel came along and kind of came into the company after directing our first show, she felt that the daring aspect sounded slightly entrepreneurial. It was a little bit Alan Sugar.
A little bit sort of car salesman. Yeah, like the daring hair, it sounded a little bit, entrepreneurial. So and also the work we were making, I don't know, it just didn't seem to line up. So then I requested that we keep it slightly similar, but change it a bit. So that then it became Dirty Hair.
Okay. You are here to talk about Gunter, an award-winning play which is transferring to the Royal Court Theatre after a sellout premiere at last year's Edinburgh Fringe. So, Rachel, you're directing it. Lydia and Julia, you are in it as well as performing various other roles. Can you, to start off with, tell me a little bit about Gunter and what it is about, please?
So, Gunter is, it's a reenactment of a real bewitchment case that happened in 1604. And basically it happened in North Morton, which is a village near Oxford. And it kind of starts off with this football match. And at this football match, there's this guy in North Morton who is basically a bit of a bastard. He's kind of richest man in the village, doesn't pay his taxes. And it starts at this football game where this man, Brian Gunter, and this isn't giving too much away, this happens very soon on in the show, kills two boys at a football match. And rightly so, their mum, Elizabeth Gregory, is feeling extremely angry and very grief-stricken. And basically she goes around the town saying, you know, Brian Gunter's this and Brian Gunter's that. And basically his ego can't handle it. And so begins his revenge plot against Elizabeth Gregory. And that basically starts with his daughter, who is already unwell at the time anyway, but it kind of begins this bewitchment. He basically starts to coerce his daughter into pretending to be bewitched in order to avenge this woman, Elizabeth Gregory, for speaking out in the town against him. And so, yeah, it's a real story. Of course, there are lots of gaps in the story from the archive, so we were able to be pretty creative in our retelling of it. And then Lydia's in the show as a historian who kind of frames the action, much to her dismay, because I kind of made her be on stage. And I think she finds it very scary.
Because Lydia, you are a historian as well, aren't you? Or an historian, as we historians like to say. I say an historian because I've got a history degree and I'm a bell end. But you actually found the story of Anne Gunther, the real life story. What was it about it that drew you to the story?
Well, actually, so I read about the story in my undergraduate, and there was a historian, a criminal historian, a brilliant historian called James Sharp, who unearthed the case at some point in the 90s. He was a historian of early modern witchcraft in England. And I kind of read about it. And basically, I think when you're studying the history of witchcraft in Europe, it feels like a very kind of distant, strange phenomenon. You're trying to get into the worldview and a belief system of people that feel very kind of far away. And I think the thing about the Gunther case is that it felt very close. You know, the story itself felt very contemporary. You know, Brian Gunther is kind of manipulating a system of oppression, basically, for his own ends, and is basically utilizing his power as a patriarch to wreak havoc on this woman's life. So I think that it felt very contemporary. I really connected with Anne's story. I thought it was an absolute rip-roarer, to be honest. I mean, I was just like, unbelievable. Each step of the story, they're doing something completely unexpected. And then actually the archives themselves are stored in Kew in the National Archives, so you can go down and have a look at them, which I did. And remarkably, the Star Chamber case that actually heard the final trial for this story, all of the decrees for that legal court have been completely lost to history. So combining the like closeness and proximity of the story to the kind of the unknownness and the kind of sprawlingness of it felt very exciting and big and challenging. And so I thought maybe it would be an interesting show.
I think that witch trials, like the witch trial kind of period, is fascinating. Like, we talk about witches literally all the time on this podcast. And I think there are like 1,000 narratives from this period that are still extremely relevant. You've brought in a couple there that hadn't even occurred to me, but like, you know, cancel culture, mob rule, misogyny, patriarchy, land ownership even. I read that what you do at Dirty Hair is you kind of take historic stories and use them to challenge the current kind of rhetoric. So what in particular were you looking to challenge with this specific case?
I think amongst the heavier kind of structural stuff that we're talking about, I think one of the narratives that I was very interested in is in some way trying to provide a more empathetic view of the past. I think that often when people talk about, you know, the history of witchcraft, as I said, you know, it feels like something very distant and far away. But I think that what's interesting about this story is that there's a very nuanced kind of discussion going on. When the judges in the first instance are kind of brought, you know, this case comes to light against Elizabeth Gregory, there's a lot of kind of weighing up and debate and, you know, and skepticism. And it shows that there was a kind of nuanced debate around what a witch actually was and how they operated in society. And I think that nuance is very interesting and not a story that's often told about the past. You know, we're kind of delivered a history of witchcraft that's kind of quite monolithic. And actually, you know, what's clear from this story is that it wasn't straightforward woman hating. You know, not everyone in this story just wanted to kill an old lady. Actually, there are particular people in particular contexts that are exploiting, you know, patriarchy, sexism, misogyny for their own ends. But actually, culture as it was understood at that time was much more colourful. And I think, you know, injecting that nuance into the story is really helpful. And I think everything with more nuance and kind of head scratching is good.
Yeah.
I guess one of the other narrative strands we look at, which is less sort of fiction based, but sort of Lydia's narrative in the show is really looking at what's deemed relevant in history nowadays. And I won't be specific because it sort of gives it away a little bit. But there is a very famous historical event which overtook Anne's story and meant that her archives sort of have disappeared into, you know, we can't find them anywhere of what happened at the end. And I think what we've been looking at as particularly sort of like modern women is people have been silenced for so long, and there's some unbelievable true stories out there, which is, I suppose, in a bit of a wanky way, that one of the narratives we're looking at is who gets to write the narrative and what are we taught about at school and what's in the textbooks. And it is quite a lot of the same old stuff, which isn't really progressing us very far. So that's definitely something that I've learned from it, and hopefully the audience get that takeaway as well.
You're transferring from obviously a much smaller venue to a much bigger venue. Are there any challenges in terms of production with that move?
I mean, it's a totally different ballgame is the biggest challenge, as in we had no production the first time. It's us three plus two actors. And the first time we rehearsed in a Quaker Centre in Tottenham for very cheap. We didn't have any design. We didn't have any. It was mostly me, Julia and Lydia kind of, you know, if we needed to make something, a design thing happen, we would go home that night, buy something from Sports Direct and see if we can make it happen. And there was something that was like really very challenging about that. But also, I don't know, those hard moments also are part of the adrenaline and seem to make it quite fun. And it's a totally different scale that we're talking about now. So now a kind of a designer's come on board. I think also a big difference is that they're architecturally very different venues. So the one at Summer Hall does a lot of the work for you. It's kind of this atmospheric old anatomy lecture theatre with a lot of history. And the Royal Court Theatre, it's like amazing, but it's much more of a black box space. And so to create atmosphere just requires different things technically. And mostly it's like, if you want to do something, there's about 15 people who are saying, right, we're going to do this, which is both amazing and also makes you feel like, wow, this is much bigger than us now, you know.
Definitely feels bigger.
Rachel, you have been an assistant / associate director at the Royal Court before, haven't you, with Ola Ince, who's actually recently been on the podcast. You worked with her on Poet in... I hate saying this because it makes me sound like a twat. Poet in the Corner.
That's it.
My apologies.
You just need to say it quickly and then it's less embarrassing. Poet in the Corner.
I've done it now. which I did see. I wondered, how does it feel to be working at this ridiculously prestigious venue? Not to put the pressure on, guys.
No. It's interesting because, of course, my kind of the whole time that I've been thinking that I want to do theatre, you look at the Royal Court and think, oh my God, if I was ever to get to do a show in there, or particularly when you're like making something like Gunther, you always have an imagination of your future self and think, I just wouldn't be able to cope. I would just think like, wow, at everything, I would just think, wow, wow, wow. And actually because it was so much work to make the show and it's just happened quite gradually, it doesn't feel as kind of, it just feels exciting and right. I don't know.
Like manageable.
Yeah. Whereas if you'd said when I was doing Poet in the Corner, oh, you'll get to also do a show there, I would have just been like, oh my God, I can't believe it. But yeah, it feels really good and really, really, really exciting.
I think for me though, I mean, like, I really have basically been studying history and playing a bit of guitar, and it was never in the career plan to be on stage at the Royal Court. So for me, I'm like, oh my Christ, that is shocking. It is shocking. I do get kind of nervous before I go on stage, but I think in a slightly wanky way, I have to like really just connect to the like purpose of what we're doing and think, get a massive grip. You know what I mean? This crazy thing happened somewhere 400 years ago and you're just there to tell that story. So, you know, go for it. But I am surprised.
And Julia actually worked here for 3 years.
Did
too,
you?
on the bar. So, yeah. So Julia's been in this venue a lot.
So how does it feel being on stage?
Well, I used to polish cutlery thinking the same as Rachel, which was like, wow, if the future version of me
ever had a play here, I would be the like happiest person in the world. And then I am actually one of the happiest people in the world. I feel, but it does, yes, it's still got feelings, still got emotion. I mean, we made Gunter at a time where we were all feeling really flat and really uninspired, and we were trying to develop shows for years with just no replies to anything, no money. And we were all feeling really frustrated and stuck. And I guess when we made Gunter ourselves, it suddenly felt like things were possible again, and we had a bit of autonomy over our work. So in those years where we were starting to make our own work, because we were getting so fed up of how underfunded theatre is, how hard it is to get anything on, and for people who run buildings, it's hellish as well. In those years, we sort of gathered enough confidence and tools, and we messed about and got things really, really wrong, like missing our tech in Edinburgh and stuff. But in those years, when you do get these opportunities, I think it feels a little bit less daunting and a little bit more like, okay, cool, what an amazing opportunity we've got. Let's really put into practice all that hard graft and all those foundations we've been building. And I mean, it's amazing to be here. I love the space. I've done a few writers' groups here, and it was a pleasure to work on the Bath so long. So it's cool to be in some football kit in the show.
Brilliant. So anything coming up next? Anything in the pipeline? You working on anything or fully focused on this at the moment?
There's a big scale musical that we are trying to get made.
Yeah, we're basically starting to do a research and development on a big musical, which we've been wanting to make for ages. And that's with a really exciting theatre, which is very close to our heart, which we can't quite say, I don't think,
okay.
If that's allowed.
And so if we want to follow this mysterious project to its conclusion, where can we find you guys on the socials?
We couldn't get the handle we wanted, so it's quite a strange handle. On Twitter, I think if you just type in Dirty Hair, you'd find us. On Instagram, it's Dirty Hair. The hair's got three E's and an underscore, but I think if you just type it Dirty Hair, you'll find it. And that is a sort of, that is bad marketing. Yeah.
So Gunter, not Gunter, is on at the Royal Court Theatre from the 3rd of April to the 25th. Best of luck. I hope it goes really well. It sounds fantastic.
Thank you so much, Jen. Thank you.
Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny off the blocks.
Welcome to Jenny off the blocks, that time of the week where we once again lament the lack of women in the room as we discuss all things women's sport. Before I start, I'd just like to say I'm on another podcast this week. Indeed, I was a woman in the room on Theo Delaney's Life Goals podcast, talking about the defining goals, as in football, and soundtrack accompanying them of my life. It's a great podcast, so do give it a listen if you have a minute. Anyway, back to the absence of women, and let's talk for a minute about a story I saw last week that global governing body World Rugby were forced to apologise after issuing misogynistic guidance on how to coach women and girls. The guidance was removed after it became clear that it was based on an academic review that was 18 years old, okay? That's not quite as bad as basing fertility guidance on 300-year-old research, but 18 years is a long time when you think about the way in which women's sports have evolved since then. So the framework listed what I can only really describe as outdated gender stereotypes. I mean, I could also describe them as bullshit, but anyway, like, for example, intellectual function for men was said to be analytical, focused, linear, logical, while for women it was whole-brained. What does that even mean? Men's innate interests were said to be things, and women's were people. Men were, it said, hardwired to systemize, while women were hardwired to empathize. These dudes probably made it onto the Conservative Party's recent second greatest global power graphic. Lols. It didn't go down well. And I'm not just talking about the Tory graphic either. It didn't go down well. And a lot of people were quite rightly like, what is this shit? After the guidance was removed, a spokesperson told the Telegraph Sport that it did not reflect the International Federation's values and known commitment to gender equality. And yet you published it, lads. So, you know. It also added that the offending text was quickly spotted and removed, but not by you. It seems that it was New Zealand journalist Alice Soper who flagged it on Twitter, leading to the backlash. People make mistakes, that's fine. I'm just saying maybe there weren't enough women in the room, because I reckon that's a mistake that might have been spotted if there were. On to some more positive news, which is that after a week's break, the Women's Six Nations is back at the weekend, with Scotland due to take on England in Edinburgh, Ireland face Wales at Musgrave Park in Cork, and France play Italy in Paris. The current state of play is that after two matches, England lead at the top of the table by just a point, with France in second place. My feeling is that it will continue in that tradition until the final match, which is between the two, as in England and France, and likely to be relatively competitive. That takes place in Bordeaux on April 27th. In cricket, England wound up a successful campaign in New Zealand last week after beating the White Ferns in two one-day internationals to take the series. That was following on from a successful 2020 series, which they won 4-1. The final one-day international of the three was won by New Zealand after their captain Sophie Devine hit a century. England were bowled out for 194 in 46.3 overs. Devine missed the first two games through injury, so maybe that picture would have been a bit different had that not been the case. England are up again in May, facing Pakistan at Edgbaston for a three-match 2020 series, which you can watch live on the BBC. Finally, congratulations to Australian boxer Skye Nicholson, who took on Denmark's Sarah Mahfood at the weekend and won on a unanimous points decision, 190, 190 and 99-91, to claim the WBC featherweight title in Las Vegas. She's hoping to take on Amanda Serrano next, who holds the other titles, and a win there would obviously see her become the undisputed champion in that weight. The Britain-based boxer said, "I want the belts. It's nothing personal to Amanda, but I'm ready when you're ready." Fighting talk indeed. That's all from me this week, and I'll be back next time with more women's sport.
Welcome to Rated or Dated. Jen, what film that we watched this week doesn't bother to answer the question, did she kill that man?
Do you know what? That didn't even occur to me, Mick.
Just gone.
Yeah. Does he ever come back? Who knows? This week we watched 1989's, in inverted commas, cult classic, Teen Witch. Or at least that is what Wikipedia is calling it. I suspect it's closer to the truth to say that some people saw a YouTube clip of Top That and thought, let's check that out. Only to find, much like the trailer for Wild Wild West, that really was the highlight. It's just so funky.
God, if that is funky, Jen.
Starring Robin Lively as protagonist Louise Miller, aka The Witch, it was apparently originally pitched as a female version of Teen Wolf, which is 1985, lads, so we can watch that next year. Indeed, there are a lot of parallels with the Michael J. Fox classic and almost every teen film I've ever seen. Louise and her buddy Polly are kind of dorky, unpopular, not cheerleaders who long for a better life, rather than the one in which Louise's seemingly normal mother dresses her for school like a pensioner from EastEnders. Louise lusts after Brad, because of course he's called Brad, who's on the school football team, and goes out with Randa, who has a weird name and is a cheerleader. Life is literally full of humiliation for Louise, not least the time when Brad runs her off the road on her bike because horny Randa is ran-handling him at the wheel. But as she walks her bicycle home, she stops off at the local fortune teller Madame Serena's house, played by a not at all typecast Zelda Rubinstein, to use the phone. She doesn't have a phone, but she does tell her she's about to become a witch, so every cloud and all that. As Serena predicts, she wakes up on her 16th birthday, apparently getting literally anything she wishes for, which is where the plot falls down a bit for me, because why can't she just wish to be the most popular girl in school, rather than involving an audience of unwitting concert goers in an elaborate ploy to get a pop star's jacket and cast a bunch of spells, eh?
I'm assuming you don't really want me to go into the numerous plot holes.
Not really. Anyway, it's almost as if she hasn't watched Teen Wolf or Big or almost any teen film I've ever seen. And she certainly never heard the old adage, be careful what you wish for. On the plus side, Brad wants to do some sexy stuff with her in an abandoned house. Ew. On the minus, being popular is exhausting and she's really fucked off Polly, who she's totally forgotten about since all this caper started. And also, she wants Brad to like her for her. So, she gives her powers back and Brad likes her anyway, and we're probably all supposed to take something away from this, but the implausibility of the ending does make it hard to do so. The end. Some fun facts I discovered about the cast of this film during my research. Robin Lively is Blake Lively's half-sister, fact number one. Mandy Ingber, who plays Polly, is now a celebrity yoga instructor, fact number two.
Lovely stuff.
Brad and Randa, that is Dan Gauthier and Lisa Fuller, are actually married.
Oh, well, that's nice.
And Zelda Rubinstein was actually super interesting and very involved in activism around HIV and AIDS. So there you go.
It didn't do very well at the box office, did it, Jen?
No, it didn't. Critics thought this film was dog shit. It didn't do terribly well at the box office. And it has an approval rating of 43% on Rotten Tomatoes.
It made like $30,000 at the box office. It did so badly at the box office.
Well, yeah. I only know about this film because my friend Harriet used to go on about it, having watched it a lot at a friend's house when she was a kid. A friend with an older sister, I think. So she introduced me to Top That, which is why I picked it. I had high hopes. There are quite a few musical numbers in this, like the particularly gut-churning I Like Boys.
Which just made me think of the IT Crowd episode where there's a song called I Love Willies. So I've just had that in my head.
The thing I read about this said that it's super camp. I don't think it's camp. I just don't think it's very good. My first question, Mick, is along those lines, do you think that this film is in any way knowing?
No. No, I don't think it's got any smarts at all. I think it's sort of a rip-off of various ideas, put together very badly, executed terribly, and I'm really sad that I watched it.
I've seen Top That, as I said. So there's a bit where they rap, a top that, and I don't really give it about that. And it's like, it's cringy, but it's hilarious. I thought that the rest of it would be funny. There's bits of it that is so bad it's funny. Sometimes you're like, is this meant to be funny? Is it meant to be funny? It's not, is it? It's not meant to be funny, I don't think.
I think of some of Serena's stuff, the older witch, is meant to be funny, but actually that comes across as quite creepy with modern eyes. Like, she is like, oh, just, you know, make him into your love slave, turn this frog into a man for me to fuck. It's all sort of like a bit like, ugh, on the consent levels now. But I think that is meant to be funny. But no, it's not even a film that's so bad it's good, you know, that you can like, oh, I can hate watch it. I just, the opener with that song and, oh, I was like, oh, I don't like it. And I just messaged Hannah and just said, you are going to be livid for a full 90 minutes because it's just terrible.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, let's talk about the women, I guess. I mean, the women are front and centre in this, but what are the representations like?
All a bit cliched, aren't they? You know, all she wants is to fall in love with the guy. And like the guy as well, like he's the jock, but he's also in the drama club. I mean, how often does that happen? I suppose that, you know, that's quite nuanced for a film about teens. And I get it. I can imagine watching it as a teenager, which I didn't, or as a young tween. And you're just like, how easy would life be if you could just wish everything that you wanted to be true? If you could just be popular and if you could just get the guy that you fancy or the girl that you fancy, whatever floats your boat, to fancy you back and it would all be perfect. And I do like that it shows that actually it isn't perfect even when you get what you want. Be careful what you wish for and all that. But it's just so badly executed that I don't want to say anything positive about it because it's awful. It's just so shoddy. Just so shoddily done. And I don't think the message is popular because it still is all about like wanting the boy to like you rather than, you know, liking yourself or anything empowering in inverted commas.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote this question for Hannah, who sadly can't join us, but I think you have similar feelings about the guy. I did wonder if you were a witch with superpowers and you could make a young Jeff Bridges fall in love with you, would you have any qualms about making it so? obviously, assuming you're not married to your lovely husband, who you're very happily married to now.
I am very happily married. I guess as a teenager, I'd probably say, yeah, let's go for it. But as a grown up, then no, because that's a whole load of consent issues. And maybe we just need to teach our young people better so they also realise it's a whole load of consent issues. But yeah, I can absolutely see the appeal of not having to try at anything and yet be given everything you want on a plate. But it isn't how life works. And yet it's still, even when she gives up the magic, is how life works in this film.
The end is stupid. It just wouldn't happen. But I mean, like, none of it would happen, so that is a ridiculous thing to say.
I let you say the end is stupid, but I was like, it's all stupid.
He doesn't know who she is. You know, all he knows about her is that she's written some, like, quite saucy stuff about him that her horrible teacher has read out in front of the class. So all he knows is that there's this girl who wears weird clothes who fancies the pants off him. He doesn't know anything about her. So what, like, in what world is he at the end just going like, yeah, I choose you? It doesn't make sense.
I think they're all fair points, Jen. But also, as a teenager, I'm not sure how much concern is given to anything other than looks, whether they'll help you with your English homework and get off with you in a spooky house, to be fair. So maybe it's like, it is quite honest in that way.
True, I guess so. I wondered, because I've chosen a few of this kind of film now.
Yes, please stop it.
Yeah. Do you have a favourite teen film at all?
Do you know what? It's really interesting because I think even though there's only 6 years age difference between you and I, that crossover from being an 80s kid to being a 90s kid is quite different, I feel, in the films that we were offered. So when you were off last week, Hannah and I watched Neverending Story, which is 1984. And it's shit, also shit, but much more childish. And so I think when I started watching slightly more grown-up films, they were stuff like Ghostbusters. There wasn't this in-between kids chasing kids thing. I was never into you John Waters films. I guess maybe The Breakfast Club, but again, it wasn't one that I returned to or that I loved. I just knew all my friends loved it. Oh, wait, Grease. There was one called Girls Just Want to Have Fun, which was probably terrible, but that I watched a lot. And I lay that at Cyndi Lauper's door because she was in it as well as, you know, writing and singing the theme tune. But yeah, probably Grease was the film that does this kind of thing much, much better that I watched again and again and again as a kid.
That's the thing, because I don't think of that as a teen film because I was watching that when I was like 8 or 9, I guess.
Yeah, me
so
too.
I suppose it was meant to be, wasn't it? It's just, yeah, I really liked 10 Things I Hate About You, which I think I've mentioned on the podcast before. I really liked that. And I worry a little bit about how that might have aged since I was watching that. I was probably about 19 when I watched that.
You can worry about how it's aged and I worry about what might happen to Hannah Dalivi if you make her watch it to find out at some point.
I'm not going to.
I think that's a wise decision. But yeah, there was this slew of kind of set in a high school thing. The thing that does this best is Buffy.
Yeah.
Which I've only ever seen as an adult, actually. But I think there's something set in a high school that discusses all of the complications and traumas, because it is such a traumatic period of transition being that age. I think Buffy nails it.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Agreed. Well, Mick, let's not fuck around any longer on this. Rated or dated?
It's dated, isn't it? Not least because of her sweater vests, although they are back and I did quite like the way she dresses, to be honest. But I don't know that it would ever have been rated, so it feels one of our moot questions. But yeah, it looks so shonky.
It's incredibly dated and, yeah, as you pointed out, did not do terribly well at the time. So was never rated, apart from by... one was Harriet Sinclair. I'm naming and shaming you. So, Mickey Noonan, I don't think it's your turn next. I think it's Hannah's turn next. So a plumbing disaster has earned
Bless
her
Hannah.
A reprieve this week.
She's got wet panic. I mean, I'm sure she's very rightly pissed off about it, but it's also quite good timing on her behalf as well. But I know what she's picked for next week. It is a 1999's election. So we're back in high school.
Oh. In a very different way, I imagine.
Shall we break into a rendition of I Like Boys, Jen?
Standard issue. for all women.